We're in the woods learning about what plants are edible, and we're expanding our knowledge of wild food here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. In the midst of the pandemic, we're taking stock of the wild edibles growing in our backyard, and there are lots of edible plants and nuts that maybe we've never thought of eating. What are your favorite wild leafy greens for salads? Have you found a prized morel mushroom before? Do you have a favorite wild berry? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's hear about it. Sam Thayer and Melissa Price are foraging experts. They're a husband and wife duo who own Forager's Harvest, teaching classes and workshops in wild food, and they have a store with books, fresh syrup, and other goods in Russ County. Melissa and Sam, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Happy to be here.
Well, Sam, I'm going to start with you and wondering, how has it been during the pandemic, and how have you guys been feeling this out?
You know, there's been a substantial increase in interest in foraging, not by us, but by other people. So we've actually been as busy as we have ever been during the last couple months.
Melissa, do you see any differences in how you are going about the business during the pandemic?
Some differences. Largely, it has mostly just been a lot busier for us. Mm. But when we do have classes, you know, practicing more social distancing, mask wearing, increased hand washing, no social or communal eating, things like that have been our primary changes, I would say.
Sam, why do you think there is this resurgence of interest in wild food here during COVID-19?
Well, what I've noticed is it isn't generally people that are new to foraging. It is people that have always had an interest, and they maybe have a little bit more free time, and so they're thinking, hey, I'm going to dive into this. And then, of course, there's this angst and this worry that people maybe aren't talking about openly, but there's this worry of societal collapse and what if I need to feed myself all by myself? And so there's that reason also that people are thinking about getting their own food. There's been a huge uptick in interest in gardening and more people fishing, everything like that.
Oh, so more of this survivalist mentality.
Yeah, or maybe more of just a back to the basics mentality.
Mm. Yeah. How do you think foraging gets back to the basics?
Well, you know, I mean, it's the primal essence of human economy. It's what our ancestors did for most of our history. And it's something, it's a skill that when you have, you can rely on at virtually any time in virtually any place.
Melissa, let's start out with what's in season right now. What kind of edible food is growing around Wisconsin?
Oh, gosh, there's so many good things growing this time of the year. There are lots of leafy greens to be consumed, and then berries. Those are kind of the two general groups. So right now here in Russ County, we have amaranth, lamb's quarters are two of the more popular greens, and purslane is just kind of coming along for us. Down in the southern half of the state, it's probably quite robust, and people have been eating that for a while now. And then we don't have mulberries up here, but down in the southern half of the state, people will be eating some mulberries and black caps. And then soon, service berries, blueberries, things like that are robust this time of the year.
Oh, you bring up so many great things. Let's start out with amaranth and lamb's quarters. Can you tell us about these greens?
Well, they're two very spinach-like greens. Okay. They're real common in disturbed areas, probably even growing along your building or parking lot. And they're excellent. You can use them in, you know, just as like steam greens, or you could have, some people like to put lamb's quarter in salads. And then the seeds later in the year can be eaten as well for both amaranth and lamb's quarter. They're just a fantastic vegetable, and we consume quite a few of them this time of the year. And I also preserve them to eat later in the year.
We're talking with Melissa Price and Sam Thayer. They're foraging experts. They run the Foragers Harvest business, where they teach classes and workshops on wild food. Do you forage for wild food in Wisconsin? Where do you go and what do you find? Are you confident that you know that what you forage for is good and edible? Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Sam, you know, Melissa was talking about what's in season now. What can we look forward to later this summer in terms of edibles?
Well, we're really just at the beginning of the berry season right now. Blueberries and blackberries, raspberries that are going to be coming on strong by mid-July into early August. That's some of the stuff that we get really excited about. We don't store a lot of food until we get to later summer. And then after that, we start getting hazelnuts and wild rice, wild plums, choke cherries, pin cherries, black cherries, all of our various wild cherries. There's so much fruit that comes on in late summer.
You know that the fruit is heavy when it stains the cement, stains the concrete when you're out on your bike rides. I noticed that recently, like the whole path was just stained with fruit.
Very true.
A lot of times when I'm running, that's how I look for the mulberry trees. You know, I just see the stain and then I know that then I need to look up, and that's where I can come back later to pick mulberries.
So how do you like to use your berries, your blueberries and your blackberries, raspberries?
We take a lot of them and just freeze them, especially the blueberries. We freeze most of what we gather. We also make fruit leathers. We dry most of the service berries that we pick. We make a little bit of jams and jelly, but we don't eat a whole lot of that ourselves. We also can some fruit. And then we pig out when they're fresh. My wife isn't going to brag, so I have to brag for her. But she picked about a half gallon of wild strawberries yesterday and made my yearly ambrosia dessert. She made a strawberry shortcake for the whole family that was just fabulous with wild strawberries she picked yesterday.
Oh, how heavenly. Melissa, that sounds wonderful.
It's one of my annual favorite things to do. I absolutely love it. I have such joy when I do it, and everyone always enjoys it. And for some reason, the patch that I picked from yesterday was particularly large and particularly juicy.
Let's bring in Christina now in Glenwood. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. Now, I have two questions. I'm all for eating in the wild, but lacking experience, it makes me nervous. And I live between Menominee and Hudson, Wisconsin. So first, I'm wondering, how do you find a foraging club so that you can actually get that visual and know that you're eating safely?
Great question, Christina. Sam?
Well, the first thing I would say is, unfortunately, there are very few foraging clubs. You'll be lucky to find a person that'll go out with you. You eventually will if you talk to enough people. But I tell people to take away that intimidation. Don't think of it as learning foraging. You just learn one plant or one mushroom at a time. And once you know that one, you'll have it for the rest of your life. So, the basic rule of foraging safety is you never eat anything unless you are absolutely certain of what it is and that it's safe. And so you'll just start with a single plant, and never know how you're going to get there. But
yeah, and Christina, we will get to your question number two in just a moment. Sam Thayer and Melissa Price are guides to wild edibles and foraging. Sam is the author of 3 books on wild food. Are you picking dandelions? How about cattails and wild garlic? How are you incorporating berries and nuts into your recipes? Join in with your questions, your stories about foraging, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about wild food and foraging here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So foraging can be defined as collecting plants or fungi like berries, nuts, mushrooms, not grown expressly for us, but the benefits, wild foods are often nutrient-dense And the ancient art of foraging connects us closer to nature. Have you found herbs like wild oregano or on your foraging heights? What about native fruits like elderberry? What do you want to know about wild edibles growing in your area? Join in 800-642-1234. We have Wisconsin wild food expert Sam Thayer and Melissa Price. They stay with us. And Christina, I want to come back to you because you had a follow-up question. You can go ahead.
Great, thanks. Now, I bought some burdock root from a food co-op, and it was absolutely delicious. And I have burdocks all over my fields, unfortunately. So I'm wondering, would this have been the same thing that I bought from the food co-op? And if so, can you advise me about how to pick and gather and, you know, and prepare that?
Melissa, could you field this one?
Sure. I can't say for certain whether it's the same kind that you have around you, but there's two basic kinds of burdock. There's common burdock and great burdock. And it probably was the great burdock. And there are ways to tell the two apart. But the great burdock, one or either burdock, really, the hardest part about it is getting out the full root. So when they grow it and cultivate it, they actually cultivate it in these nice little raised bed-like things that they can take apart and get the full tender root. The top portion of burdock tends to be real tough. And so if you're digging it out of your yard or even your pasture, sometimes you or people are unable or unwilling to dig the massive hole it takes to get the big root out to get the tenderest part. So then they end up with the top part and they're pretty dissatisfied because it's tough and not as flavorful as what they've had in the past.
I'm looking at pictures of it right now. This looks like a stick or something. So how would you use it in a recipe?
I would say one of the most common ways we use it is to just, you know, gather it, clean it off, scrub it off real well with a vegetable brush, and chop it up and put it in soups. Or you could saute it and put it in with other dishes like a rice dish or something like that. Peel the outer part of the, you know, like you would a carrot kind
sure.
of thing.
Yeah, to get
I would
off
say those
that.
Are the two.
To get off some of that tough outer you know, core on that. Sam, what would you add about burdock?
Well, you know, when you buy things, you get the shelf-stable part of the plant. But a lot of plants have a less shelf-stable part that is easier to use and maybe better. And burdock is a great example of this. So the root is good, but as Melissa said, it's hard to get that out of the ground. But what you can also use on the burdock is the peeled stalk. There's no digging involved. So if you get it at the right time of year, which would be, we're past that time now when the stalks are like knee high or shorter, you can cut them at the base and peel the outside. And you basically have a burdock root in reverse, like upside down, tapering the other way. And that is more tender than the root. Similar flavor, not exactly the same, not quite as sweet, but that's also great in stir fries or soups. And this is a mega vegetable. I mean, a burdock root or stalk on a real big plant can weigh over a pound. So this is a great labor-efficient vegetable to use. And you can use the roots or the stalks on any of the species of burdock.
Christina, does that help?
You bet. Thank you very much.
Thank you so
I'm
much.
Get
for...
out there.
Yeah, good. Yeah, all right. Christina, thanks for calling. Sam Thayer and Melissa Price are foraging experts. They have a business on wild food and a store in the Village of Bruce. We're talking about foraging this hour with your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Russ now, joining us from Pleasant Springs. Hi, Russ.
Hi, good morning. About 40 years ago, I used to go mushroom hunting with my buddy's Uncle Albert in the woods in Illinois, and he knew all about mushrooms. He would point out the ones that we could collect and the ones we couldn't. And a lot of the ones, the button mushrooms especially, that were edible looked exactly like the ones that might have been poisonous. And I'm wondering, is there a definitive book that your guests could recommend with color pictures to point out which ones you can cut?
Sam, can you feel that? How do we know that mushroom is safe to eat?
Well, there's never any general rules that apply. It's you learn each individual edible species, and to the uninitiated, they may look identical, but they're never identical. Kind of like if you'd never seen iceberg lettuce and green cabbage, you would think they looked the same. But if you have made coleslaw your whole life, you know that only one is for coleslaw. So foraging is similar. As far as the right books, there's actually quite a few good books on mushrooms. And, you know, some people like the big, thick Mushrooms Demystified that has more, it has photographs and detailed descriptions. There are, you know, there's a whole bunch of different field guides that are available now with great color photographs for mushrooms. Mushrooms of the Midwest, there's Falcon Guides. Melissa probably knows the names of the guides better than me because she's the one usually selling them.
Melissa, can you add anything on mushrooms and how to tell them apart?
Well, the one guide that is kind of new that recently came out was the Mushrooms of the Northeast, and that's a Timber Press guide. They kind of have some for all the different regions. Actually, I'm not sure if it's all the different regions, but several of the regions throughout the United States. That's a new, very nice one. There's also a Mushrooms of the Upper Midwest. That's a nice guide by Teresa Maroney. And I would say that those are a couple of the more popular ones, as well as the Audubon Mushroom Field Guide that tends to be pretty popular and I sell quite a few of.
Well, Russ, did you jot all that down?
Well, I tried to, but I'll look for those. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for calling. You know, when you're going out there, Sam, how are the ways that foraging, how can that serve as a teaching tool for conservation and good environmental stewardship?
I'm glad that you bring this up because I feel that foraging is a kind of a missing part of the conservation movement, because foraging, you know, taking a plant or anything else and eating it creates this instinctive response that we call gratitude. And that feeling of gratitude translates into an incredibly powerful conservation ethic. And, you know, the gatherers of wild food were the original and most successful sustainable managers of the ecology of this continent. And I think we need to bring that back into the way that we practice conservation. So, you know, foraging can be done unsustainably, but that is pretty rare. And that's because of this feeling of gratitude that you automatically develop when you gather food. The foragers that I know are deeply involved in conservation. For example, collecting spring vegetables. Every forager that I know that avidly collects spring vegetables also avidly removes invasive plants, such as garlic mustard or moneywort, or many of the various invasive plants that are competing with the native plants that we're eating. And so there's really no other way to develop that deep sense of appreciation. And I think we would do great to have a lot more foragers. We love milkweed in our house, and we have about a half acre of managed milkweed patches, which is great for butterfly conservation and just native plant conservation. This is one example of the ways that this gratitude reverberates through people's actions.
Melissa, how are you using the milkweed?
Oh, we like the shoots a lot. We the tender shoots when they first come up, which we're past that season right now, they're excellent sauteed in a little butter or steamed. And then we also like to use the flower clusters, which those are just starting to come on pretty strong around here. You can use them right before the flowers open or even after the flowers open. And then we also like to use the pods after the fresh young pods. When you crack them open and you see the white inside, when you press with your thumbnail or fingernail, you need to still see some juice coming out. That tells you that they're still tender. So sometimes we'll preserve some of those for later in the season if we have a nice big patch and we can collect some nice young pods And you can saute them up as well if you wanted to eat them fresh.
So really using, and, yeah, go ahead, Sam.
But you want to make sure you eat the milkweed cooked, however.
Eat the milkweed cooked. Foraging experts Sam Thayer and Melissa Price, they're our guides this hour. They run Foragers Harvest in northern Wisconsin. Do you have recipes that call for wild plants? What do you do with your milkweed? Have you tried dandelions in your salad? What do you think? If you forage, do you go out alone or with the family? What do you find and how do you prepare wild edibles? How do you feel about your confidence in picking them? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Sam Thayer and Melissa Price right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Wild edibles are all around us. We're learning about foraging here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A weedy hayfield or the thickets near a stream or a pond may have some wild foods that we've never considered eating. How often do you go out to forage for local edibles like native fruits and mushrooms? What are you finding? What questions do you have about the wild berries in your own backyard? Time to talk, 800-642-1234. Sam Thayer's most recent book is called Incredible Wild Edibles, and he stays with us along with his spouse and business partner, Melissa Price. They're foraging experts. Well, when Russ was talking about mushrooms, it made me think about the morels and how sacred those mushrooms are, how rare they are. And I'm wondering now that the season, I think, for morels is kind of done in Wisconsin. Sam, did you find any this season?
You know, this is the first year maybe in my life that I did not find a single morel. And I don't know what I attribute that to. I did not go on a morel expedition this year, but I actually didn't find any this spring.
You just didn't run into any either.
Yeah. I mean, we don't live in great morel country up here in Russ County. There are morels here, but it's not like the Driftless area where I would expect to see morels any day I'm out. But I was out a whole day in the Driftless area on May 10th, and I didn't see a single morel. And it was a little early. The phenology was early this year, so they maybe weren't popping up in the area where I was, but I did not see one this year when I was down.
Why are they considered such a jewel? Why are they so expensive?
Well, one is they're really good. I mean, if you like mushrooms, this is, you know, there are a few mushrooms I like as much, but none that I like better. And the other thing is, I would say it's partly that they are so common and predictable. Now, it seems like they're not common, but over much of the country, you can expect to find morels any day that you go out during morel season, whereas many other mushrooms are much harder to find. So there's enough to supply it. Kind of a continuous market during that time of year, so that you can actually get them every year. So I think both, and they're one of the only spring mushrooms. There's not as nearly as many spring mushrooms as there is late summer and fall mushrooms. So it's really the best of all the spring mushrooms.
Melissa, when I'm out on hikes, you know, I see these gigantic Smurf House mushrooms. I mean, they're so big; they feel really woody. Is there any use for these really large mushrooms going at the base of trees?
Well, there's lots of different kinds of mushrooms that grow at the bases of trees, and some are excellent edibles. And the one that you were describing was probably something called an Amanita. And those are not edible. The giant, beautiful, usually orange mushrooms that grow sometimes at the base of trees. Or it could have also been something called the jack-o'-lantern mushroom, which also is not edible. So it's real important to understand what kind of habitat you're going to find the mushroom in that you're looking for, and different things that are, just because it's orange doesn't mean that it is an edible mushroom. So it's just real important to look at lots of different features, the underside, the top of it, as well as where it's growing to know whether it's a mushroom that you'd be interested in eating or not.
What might the underside look like if it is edible? Jump in there, Sam.
I was just going to say, Kate, it sounded like you were you describing a shelf fungus growing right on the tree or a fungus with the stem that was growing near the tree? Because those are, be two very important features that you would be a starting point for identifying it. Does it have a stem or is it a shelf growing out of the side of wood?
Because actually it was on a shelf growing out the side of wood, and I don't even know if the tree itself was alive because it was horizontal.
Okay, yeah, so then that would be a basic question. Another one is look at the underside, and is it hard and woody? Does it have tiny little holes that you can barely see with the naked eye? Does it have honeycomb-like holes, which would make it a bolete? Or does it have gills, typical radiating paper-like gills? So that's the kind of those are some of the basic questions you would ask in the identification process.
Melissa, what do you love about mushrooms?
What I love about mushrooms, especially wild mushrooms, is that there's such a wide array of different flavors and even different textures. So some people who say that they don't like mushrooms, and often they mean mushrooms you can buy in the store, is a texture thing. So there's actually some wild mushrooms that are much more firm, and so people find them a lot more palatable. But I just love the wide array of different flavors. There's just so much different things that you can, different kinds that you can get and different flavors that you can get. I would say that that's my most favorite thing about mushrooms. And they're elusive too. They're, you never know for sure, are you going to find any? And then sometimes when you find them, you just find lots and lots of them.
Well, we're going to move on here and talk more about berries with Ida. Hi, Ida.
Hi.
What is your question?
Well, we were told by a local friend of ours about a berry called a Juneberry, and we've picked them with him before, but we can't seem to find a lot of information about what the Juneberries actually are. They're not a blueberry. They're a darker, sweeter type berry. So I'm wondering if you guys have any information on those.
Sam, what about the Juneberries?
Well, Juneberries go by a lot of names. That's also called serviceberry. It's also called Saskatoon in Canada. And Saskatchewan, the province, was named, and the city of Saskatoon, the capital, was named for that fruit. This was one of the most important fruits for Native people in North America. At the time of European settlement, and is still commonly collected. These are great, probably my favorite fruit in the world. So we have six species, I believe, native to Wisconsin. They're all similar. Usually people learn them as a group. They're hard to tell from each other. But the ripening season where all six are found extends for probably 7 weeks. So they're more common in northern Wisconsin. They are statewide. But in the Madison area, for example, you would have one or two species you can easily find. And near Lake Superior, you would have all six species.
Are they all dark colored, or what is the coloring on them?
Well, they ripen first to pink, then to red, then to dark purple. And depending on where you are in the state, you may never see the dark purple ones because the birds will pick them off before they get that ripe. But if you can find a good crop and they get to the dark purple stage, that is when they are best. But you can eat them as long as they're soft.
Ida, where are you finding them?
We find them all over up by us. Lots of different forest areas. There's a few like bird sanctuary areas and stuff like that we find a lot of blueberries, raspberries, and then the Juneberries.
How do you use them in your cooking?
We mostly eat them before we get home.
I love it. I love it. I think Sam and Melissa would be in your camp.
For sure.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Ida. you know, Sam, for people who live in urban areas, in neighborhoods with a city all around them, foraging, you know, seems like it's something you can't really do, but that's not true. What is urban foraging about?
Well, I grew up mostly in Wausau and Madison in the city, and I was an avid forager. When you're in an urban area, you don't have certain things, but other things you have a lot more of. A lot of the weedy plants, the lamb's quarters and amaranth we mentioned earlier, things like evening primrose that are weedy, mulberries. A lot of these things are most common in the city. The big worry in the city is, where can I pick without someone getting upset with me? And the other part is, has this been sprayed with herbicide? But you have a huge array of edibles that are in urban areas. Wild grapes, for example. Every urban area in this state has a lot of wild grapes. And they may be growing along a fence in an alleyway, or they may be growing along a brushy area in a park. But you need to find out what are the regulations for picking, or get to know your neighbors. The people on your block, you probably know. And if they have a mulberry tree in their front yard, it's a good chance they're going to say, go for it. Pick all you want.
Melissa, what can you do with wild grapes? What have you done with them?
Well, of course, they're excellent snacks just right off the bush. Our children pick clusters of them from around our orchard all the time and just eat them right off the bush. But we also make some jellies that we sell and use ourselves. And another great thing you can do as well is just press the grapes, which you have to do to make the jelly as well. Press the grapes for their juice, and then you need to set it in the refrigerator for, you know, at least 24 hours to let something called tartrate settle out of it. If you consume a bunch of that, it will leave like a scratchiness in your throat, the tartrate that settles out. And then if you include it in your jelly, it will actually make this funky, granulated sort of texture to your jelly. But those are some of the more popular ways. So you can then just sweeten the juice to your flavor and preserve it or freeze it if you want. Those are some excellent things to do.
Sounds like you do quite a bit of freezing and preserving.
We do. We do lots of freezing and preserving. We try to preserve as much stuff, either pressure canned or hot water bath, depending upon the particular product, as we can, because we have limited freezer space. There's only so much room in a freezer.
We have Melissa Price and Sam Thayer, who are Wisconsin foraging experts in the North Woods. What wild edibles are you on the lookout for this summer? What's good to eat now? Where do you like to forage? And what questions do you have about the wild food you see off the beaten path? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Sam Thayer and Melissa Price here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're learning about foraging this hour, the array of edibles that we see along our biking trails and the overgrown lots and neighborhoods on the banks of ponds and streams. We're learning how to identify with confidence and then how to incorporate wild foods into our cooking. What do you want to know about the ethics of foraging? How do you treat wild foods in your community? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Foraging experts Sam Thayer and Melissa Price stay with us. So, Sam, you were saying that to be very careful around plants that have been sprayed for herbicides, pesticides, things like that. What if you don't know if a wild plant has been sprayed? Can you wash the plant enough?
You know, I don't know if you can wash the plant enough. That's a really tricky situation. And this is one that's kind of new. The herbicides have been used in the last 20 years to an incredible extent. You know, they're spraying them in right in waterways. They're being sprayed on sides of roads where 20 years ago it was safe to forage things. And if there's any sign of wilting or unusual growth form in the plant, any unusual coloration, don't pick there. It's easy for us because we forage a lot right on our 60 acres that we own. But this is a tricky thing to navigate and probably the scariest part of foraging. To the non-forager, they're often worried about misidentification, but us foragers, we just eat what we know and leave it there. But the herbicide thing is a little bit hard to navigate.
Another tricky thing is, what are the laws around foraging on public lands like state parks?
Yeah, so our state parks in Wisconsin allow you to collect berries, mushrooms, nuts, and fruits, and they say asparagus also. And that's very reasonable, I think, in our state parks. Our state forests, I believe, are similar. You want to find out on public land the particular jurisdiction that has authority there and find out what the foraging regulations are.
What about private land? Is that ever okay?
Well, it's okay if you have permission. It's same permission as with hunting or fishing or any other outdoor activity. I mean, if you ask someone in a rural area about picking something they've heard of, elderberries, for example, if they don't pick them, it's very likely they say, go for it. And a lot of foraging in rural areas happens like right on the side of the road. People just stop and pick some berries on the side of the road, and that's sort of a gray area. It depends on where you are and who your neighbors are. Well, I would just advise just talk to people and be respectful, and you generally aren't going to have any problem.
Melissa, take us to your 60 acres. What is your orchard like?
Oh, our orchard is kind of a foraging paradise. We've slowly added different wild edibles if they don't exist. We have over 200 apple trees, which aren't wild. And in between all those apple trees and things, we've incorporated things like nanny berries, high bush cranberry, elderberries. And then, of course, there's wild strawberries, and there's burdock, and just a wide, vast variety of different things. We've included some hops vines, wild hops, to grow up our orchard fence, and wild plums. We've got lots of different wild plums. Over the years, we've selected varieties that we like in particular and grow the biggest, juiciest fruit. And so we have a bunch of those, and we make jams and jellies from them. And then we also peel the skins off of some of those wild plums and preserve them for later in the season. They're excellent that way.
How do you nurture wild? Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, we also introduced things such as cow parsnip, ostrich fern, those kinds of things.
I just love these names. I just wonder where they come from.
Well, cow parsnip is actually, in Russian, is borscht. You may have heard that word. This plant was so synonymous with soup in Europe that in several languages, its name has been applied generally to soup. In England, they call it hogweed, but this is an example of an incredibly versatile vegetable that people never domesticated because it spontaneously appeared on farms throughout Europe. And the tradition has been largely lost in North America.
And that kind of gets us back to why foraging is this age-old craft, and just, you know, how it goes back so many, you know, centuries. Well, Sam and Melissa, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Oh,
it was great
you
to be here.
Sam Thayer and Melissa Price run the Foragers Harvest, where they teach classes and workshops on edible food. They also have a store in Bruce, Wisconsin. Over 150,000 Wisconsinites are waiting for their unemployment claims to be processed. And while the state has added hundreds of staff to manage the backlog, many laid-off Wisconsin workers have gone months without any source of income. Bram Sable-Smith reports.
By the time David Ficke was laid off from his welding job in March, hundreds of thousands of Wisconsinites had already filed unemployment claims. Ficke did too, hoping the financial assistance would help him survive as the pandemic shut down much of the state's economy.
It's an online process, which is actually pretty easy.
In addition to the initial application, Ficke has to file a new claim each week he's unemployed. But all of his claims are on hold as the state investigates his work history. And when he tried calling the helpline...
Thank you for calling the Wisconsin Unemployment Claimant Assistance Line. We are sorry, but our queues are currently full.
Ficke said he saw the writing on the wall. He'd be waiting a long time for financial help in a first-come, first-served system drowning in a flood of claims. Rather than risk getting evicted, he traded his apartment in Beaver Dam for a stay at the Hotel Chrysler. That's his 2006 town and country minivan. Ficke drove out to Minnesota to be near his daughter, who was staying with his ex-wife. His ex was shocked by his arrangement.
She's like, "You're staying in a minivan?" I'm like, "Yeah. I got the seats folded down. I've got, you know, my power converter. I've got a slow cooker. You know, I'm good to go."
His former in-laws insisted he move in with them, too. And that's how he ended up living with his ex-wife, her parents, and her new boyfriend.
It is what it is.
Ficky's not alone in his wait for help. Over 150,000 people in the state have pending unemployment claims. By mid-June, the Department of Workforce Development was still making its way through some pending claims from March. And more than 20,000 new people are filing claims each week. That's left tens of thousands of laid-off workers frustrated and without income.
I've been involved in rehoming 14 families that have become homeless because of this.
Shannon Times Rainwater helps organize a Facebook support group for people dealing with the state's unemployment system. It has nearly 4,000 members. Times Rainwater herself waited over 2 months for her assistance to arrive this Saturday. In that time, she had to make the difficult decision to place her daughter with special needs in a group home when her family could no longer afford caregivers.
It's not favorable. But as her support team, we all agree that her being home right now without her in-home staff, we just can't do it.
She says Governor Tony Evers and DWD Secretary Caleb Frostman have lacked urgency on the unemployment crisis.
16 weeks, people have gone without income and nobody cares.
There are many reasons for the wait. The biggest is the onslaught of over 3.5 million weekly claims since March. DWD's had to bring on over 1,000 new people to staff the phone lines and adjudicate claims one by one. Also, the agency's technology is from the 70s and takes a long time to program. But these issues have been known about for years, and state lawmakers never acted to correct them. Instead, a dozen laws passed since 2011 restrict access to unemployment. Secretary Frostman says the newly hired staff are beginning to help his agency process claims faster.
If they're found eligible and have been making their weekly claims, they'll get every dollar they're entitled to, including back pay.
But he knows even back pay will not fix every hardship of living months without income. Wisconsin's not alone in these struggles. Backlogs have been reported in places like Florida, Pennsylvania, and Kentucky. Washington called in the National Guard to process claims. And Nevada's unemployment chief resigned after receiving threats from frustrated claimants. David Ficke is back in Wisconsin. He says he understands why it could take the state a few weeks to get their system ready for so many claims.
But when you're out 8, 9, 10, 11, and beyond, you have to be able to do something for the people that help fund your state.
And as he waits, he has no choice but to try to nab work as the pandemic rages on. Bram Sablesmith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And that story comes from a partnership between WPR and Wisconsin Watch. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.